when you rigidly hold on to something and the thought and it's fueled by so much fear, you can be missing out on the bigger picture. You know, whether it's a relationship or an image of where your career is going to go or whatever it is, it's just like, can we kind of pause for a second and say, where's my quality of life? Like, am I happy? Do I feel whole? Like, I like the way you said it. Can you feel whole here versus is everything feeling aligned and whole? And that's what it felt like. It's like, I'm just trying to keep this whole.
Welcome to Deconstructing Therapy, transforming therapy and the therapists who lead it. Let's deep dive into conversations, reshaping therapy into a powerful tool for healing, liberation, and systemic change. Join us as we challenge the status quo, reimagine care, and celebrate therapists breaking barriers. Let's transform therapy together.
So we're doing something different today. I've had a lot of guests who are really brave and vulnerable on here that have shared their story. And I've kind of wanted to do the same for an episode for my guests and for everybody who's kind of shared their heart with me. So Nalini was very gracious enough to show up today to play the host role.
I am totally honored to be here today to play the host role. And I actually don't know if I told you this, Alifia, but my partner had heard about your podcast before I even met you. So when I had said, I'm going to be interviewed by Alifia Taki, my partner was like, wait, who? And I was like, well, she has this podcast called Deconstructing Therapy. And my partner was like, I know that person. I was like, oh.
Are they a therapist?
They're a therapist.
Okay. Awesome.
And they're really into sort of their own anti-racist work and understanding you know, systems and how that influences us. And they were really excited about your podcast. And even more excited that I was invited to speak with you. So
that's awesome. Maybe I can interview them for season two.
Oh, for sure. I'll let them know. Well, I appreciate being able to be here and sort of be the one who asks questions about your life and get to help sort of extract your story and understand who you are and how you are and why you are. And I sort of just want to start with, tell me a little bit about your story. Like, tell me about your childhood. I feel like I'm very therapist-y, and I feel like our childhood really impacts, you know, right, how and why we are.
You start doing these as like attachment histories. That's how it feels like all the time.
So if we talked about sort of what about your family upbringing and maybe cultural upbringing you feel like really influences who and how you are today. Maybe we could just start there.
I guess it's a lot of complex history for sure. But I'm the youngest of three daughters. I was the only one born in the U.S. Most everybody else in my family born in Pakistan. My dad's born in India. He was born before Pakistan existed. Very chaotic upbringing. A lot of stuff that just is typical because of immigrant culture and like what they had to go through to come here. And well, both parents have had a lot of trauma. My mother's mother was bipolar. My dad had a lot of trauma from the partition of India and Pakistan, where he lost his family and kind of had to be raised away from his siblings and his parents for most of his life and stuff. So they were just kind of coming in with a lot of stuff, just stuff from being an immigrant and kind of, you know, assimilating to a new culture, all that stuff that's passed down. So my role in the family system was just kind of more staying out of the way, being quiet. I had selective mutism as a child, very, very like painfully quiet, just big journey. I think a lot of people who probably knew me as a child and see that I'm like hosting a podcast, like, we've never heard your voice ever.
This is the most we've ever heard.
Yeah. So a lot of evolution.
Well, I know we're laughing, and I think it's always good to be able to look back and sort of find humor. But it sounds like it was a really painful experience and chaotic and scary. And the way that you sort of managed was sort of staying out of the way to the point of really not even speaking your voice, your thoughts.
Yeah, basically it's not speaking, not getting in the way, and a lot of disassociating. Like, I think I lived there, I lived in fantasy world.
It probably kept you intact in a kind of way.
Yeah, for sure.
When did you feel like that sort of shifted and you were able to come more into this world?
I think college was one shift, where I was very intentional, like kind of tired of like really cowering and playing small and all that stuff. And I very intentionally shifted because I was like, I'm it's a whole new crowd of people who don't know me. So I can start coming out a little bit more of my shell. So that was one shift. And then EFT world. I mean, the first time I ever even raised my hand in class was EFT externship, like in my 30s, right? So it's just never talked in a group until then. That was a big shift for me. EFT, that world, that community, I think that most of my dear friends are still ones that I did externship with. It was just a very transformative experience.
Well, I noticed too, we went from childhood to like being a therapist already, but I know that there's a huge chunk in between. Did you study psychology in college? Like, tell me a little bit about your college experience, or even, you know, when we're at that age where we're exploring the world, we have ideas of what we want to be.
I did study psychology. I studied psychology starting even in high school. Like, I took like college level psychology in high school, studied psychology, majored in psychology, thought I was to be, you know, going to become a psychologist. And always, because I was so quiet, I was just very observant of everybody else. So it was just a natural thing for me. And I'm just picking up also, because like I skipped, like I was like, I went from college to that. And the thing that I skipped, the thing was I was talking to you about earlier, was like that period of time almost feels like separate from all of it, my whole 20s, because I was sick. Right. So like in my early 20s, like right, I think it was like right after I had graduated college, or a little bit after that when I had started working or something. But I had gotten like a very, very severe eye infection, super rare, had a parasite in my eye, which they didn't figure out for a very long time. So it was in debilitating pain. Nobody knew what it was. So I was going from doctor to doctor, just trying to understand what was wrong with me. I had lost my eyesight like overnight. I was swollen, couldn't see the sun. Like it was just like a debilitating period of time. And then when they did get the diagnosis, it was just so rare that we couldn't treat it. So for years and years and years, I was just like this kind of patient, just living at the doctor's office, going to the doctor's office, driving from New York or New Jersey to Philadelphia every other day, hours on end. They were literally taking like pool cleaner and distilling it and putting in my eye just to try to get rid of it. It had taken over my existence for like a really long time. Yeah. And I had, you know, finally we were looking up experimental different surgeries and things like that. And we had found like an experimental surgery in Germany where they took placenta from a woman, like amniotic fluid, sorry, from a woman's belly when she was pregnant and used that to heal. And, you know, it worked. And the doctors were willing to do it. I had gotten better. That was maybe like a year in or something. So I'm starting to get better. But this was still like this chronic thing that I was dealing with for like years and years. So it's like I would have eyesight. My eye was so damaged. I was like taking drops every few hours. My life kind of revolved around it. I would always get infections. I had two different transplants. So I would get a transplant, get better for a little bit, still in a little bit of pain, always had glaucoma, always had all these other issues. So my life kind of all my 20s kind of revolved around like caring for my eye. And then making sure that it stays intact and being very hypervigilant about doctors, because there's so much in the medical world where I was like not diagnosed properly or not given the proper treatment. And we had to like be this huge advocate for ourselves. So luckily I had a very educated family and a pharmacist and this and that. So we would kept like up with it, but it had to be some like this hypervigilance. Okay. Are we looking at all the most up-to-date research? Are we telling them what to do? Am I constantly making sure my eye's not getting blurry and that the rejection is not coming up again and I need to get in the, you know? So it was just, yeah, it had taken over my life of like making sure I still have two eyes and then I'm not losing it. It literally took over my life. And I was in a little bit of pain, I think, every day. I didn't even realize. It was just chronic. Yeah. Yeah. When it's chronic, you don't know it. It starts shifting to like just being a little bit more irritable or like out of it or tired more or something. Like your body doesn't register it as pain anymore.
Well, I also say that sounds so scary because you're still pretty young in your 20s and you have this sense of your whole life's ahead of you. And here you are just really in this moment with the uncertainty and the fear. Like, that must have been so hard.
Yeah. The fear that you're always, something's going to go wrong. And I think missing out, because 20s, you're like your friends, everybody's dating, everybody's like
having fun, being out there, and you're not able to have that. You said like, okay, we started the childhood and we sort of skipped this part. But how do you think this part of your life impacted sort of who and how you are today?
In so many ways, I think I've thought about this a lot, because that whole period of time, it was like, this is what I have to do. The thought of having only one eye, because I know other people with this infection have had that. It was like, you thought about it for a second, it would scare me, or like being permanently blind, that would scare the hell out of me. So it's like, okay, my retina's fine, back of my eye's fine. Even if I've lost my vision multiple times through this journey, like I was very hyper-focused on making sure I don't permanently lose my vision, don't permanently lose my eye. Like, that was my goal. And I was good at it. I stayed on top of everything, always did it. And then, you know, and I had this port in my eye kind of put in because the glaucoma was like gotten so bad. They had to create a port. I had to get chemo injections in there and stuff. When I was pregnant with my second child, that port had gotten infected. And because it's a port, it's like, mm-hmm. you know, infection was like rapidly increasing. I was 8 months pregnant. And so because of that, and because of the healthcare in Alabama is just horrendous, there was just neglect and all these horrible things happened. I was kind of left without any decent medical care for a whole day in a hospital, like just begging for medical care and like severe pain, and they wouldn't even give me anything. But by the time they treated me or stuff, I was like, it was a little bit too late. The eye was shrinking, you know, I was feeling better, but that was a horrible day. That was just like a helpless, like 8 months pregnant. I'm like laying in the bed, my eyes the size of like an orange. And I'm just like begging for them to give me some medicine or something. But they're like, oh, we can't coordinate enough to get the orders, or this failed or that, you know, it was ridiculous things. But there was a helplessness. It was really like probably one of the lowest points. But then like, so 2 weeks after that, I went into labor. Which, of course, you know, that happens. You kind of go in early or late if your baby knows there's something going on. So mine was a little bit early. I had planned for a home birth before all of this. You know, I didn't want to be part of the whole medical system, all that stuff.
For good reason, yeah.
Yeah. And so I was 1 week shy of making the home birth time, right? I was 37 weeks. Like, midwife had kind of required 38 weeks for safety. They still came over. They helped me like labor at home and all that, but they couldn't let me do the birth at home. So I had to go to the hospital very reluctantly. And I went there, and you know, that's where my trauma just happened two weeks ago, where I'm trapped in this place and I'm like laying in a bed helpless, like begging for like doctors to see me, to help me or whatever. So I didn't want to be there. I kind of was really, really in labor at that point. Second child, so like it goes faster. I kind of just barged into some labor room because I didn't even have it within me to like go through the process of what they make you do, signing in and all that. I was like ready to just go. And I just went into a room. I started doing my, you know, Lamaze breathing, all that stuff. And they wanted to check my dilation, wanted to do, you know, all the poking, prodding. And I just kept like, nope, do not touch me. My husband was just like signing off waivers and stuff. And they were just getting annoyed with me. The doctor wasn't there. And then this one nurse came up to me, like kind of was in my face, like really angry. And she's like, you have to wait for the doctor to get here for you to do this stuff. Or like, why'd you come here if you didn't want our help?
That's so aggressive.
Yeah, they were really aggressive because they just wanted me to follow protocol. And so I took my yoga mat and I stormed into the bathroom and I just put my mat down, locked myself up, and I gave birth by myself.
Wow.
Yeah. And so that to me was like the shift.
Yeah. That were like the epitome of like how terrible the medical system cumulatively had been to you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was like a powerful moment. It was just like, I'm taking my power back from them. I'm taking my body back. I like just trusted my body instead of like, if I'm in pain, I'm going to go to you so you could hook me up to something and then show me a snapshot and tell me what's happening inside of me and what to do. Like, I'm just going to trust that. I know it's time to push. I know what to do. And it felt very empowering. Especially also throughout that pregnancy, my doctor had told me I wasn't going to be able to give birth, that placenta was too small, or that I was probably going to have the C-section. There was all kinds of crap. My amniotic fluid, like all kinds of stuff that I was told. The fact that I was able to kind of just check in with my own wisdom and do that for myself was like, that felt like a turning point. I'm going to just trust myself. I can do this. Felt very in tune with my child. And so that shifted a lot of things. And there started to be a shift after that as well.
How old were you at that
time? 33. This is my second kid. Yeah. So it was from like 23 when I first got sick. And that was like 33. And then that kind of began my journey of like deciding to take my eye out, which was a huge, I mean, took like a year after that to still actually make the decision. But this whole time it was like, I have to have two eyes. I cannot lose my vision permanently. That's not a thought. To like, I'm losing my life when I'm clinging to that goal. Like, I had already lost my quality of life. I had already lost my power. I had already like was in pain all the time. Okay, me clinging to this, like, which is important, it's a part of me, it's a part of my body, it's a part of my face. You know, it's sad to lose that, but it's just clinging to that so tightly. Everything else around it was falling apart.
That's so profound because you realize this obsession with staying whole here had made you lose so many parts of yourself. You were like, forget it.
Forget it. Yeah. So it was a hard decision because especially there was still a little bit of hope. I could have gotten some more, you know, experimental stuff. So making that decision, I think that shifted me profoundly. And, you know, that kind of pattern went to a lot of other things. When you rigidly hold on to something and the thought and it's fueled by so much fear, you can be missing out on the bigger picture. You know, whether it's a relationship or an image of where your career is going to go or whatever it is, it's just like, can we kind of pause for a second and say, where's my quality of life? Like, am I happy? Do I feel whole? Like, I like the way you said, yeah, can you feel whole here? Versus is everything feeling aligned and whole. And that's what it felt like. It's like, I'm just trying to keep this whole.
At what cost?
That was one big lesson from that. I think also just trusting my body. And I think that I pour that into my clients as well. I know we say this all the time, but we don't often really believe it. It's like we see a little snapshot of them once a week. Yeah. We do not know our clients. And we just see the snapshot that they happen to show up with that week too. So you know yourself and your body has so much wisdom. It really does. No doctor, no professional, like nobody can tell you who you are, or what's right for you.
What also sounds like all these experiences with the medical professionals brings to you a kind of humility in your work, recognizing this idea that you only see them for one moment a week, that they have their experience of themselves and you're just seeing them in a snapshot. I'm imagining that comes from your experiences of being disbelieved or people telling you what's going on for you and all these other things and knowing that's not right.
Exactly. Even when it was worse, because in the beginning, it was actually really worse as parasite or whatever. And they thought it was something else. Oh, you're not in that much pain. Like it kind of almost went both ways, a lot of stuff. And the pharmaceutical company, because the parasite came from a faulty pharmaceutical company. Uh-huh. And so even I, you know, had to read a lot of the internal documents of how that even came to be and the corruption and all that. So I've, you know, had trauma from all kinds of medical abuse.
That's a lot to deal with at that young age or that formative age. And to get to this place where it's almost like this in somatic experiencing or in sensory motor psychotherapy, there's this idea of like the act of triumph where you let go of all the things that had like the beliefs, the core beliefs that you have, and you're able to do the thing that you couldn't do before. When you go into the bathroom and you put your yoga mat and you're like, forget all of you. I'm going to do it. I have me. I'm the only one who knows me. And I can't trust you guys to actually care about what's going on for me as much as I can.
Exactly.
And that really shifted your life. It freed something up in you. It probably also enabled you to make that difficult decision later that you don't need two eyes to live a full life, right? That in fact, you had been missing out on life, right? Holding on to this. I'm wondering, and maybe this is a question you probably already considered, but how do you think sort of being Pakistani American person in Alabama or also interacting with the medical field, how do you think that impacted the care you received or how people experienced you?
That's the first thing that comes up to me is just Black women when you say that, because I can't just seeing how horribly they've been treated is just, I just think of my privilege as almost as a Pakistani woman. There's so many people who automatically like think I'm a doctor here because I'm Pakistani. And that's most of their experience. There's not many immigrants here at all. The ones that are in the medical profession. They come from student visas and stuff. So in a lot of ways, I actually get treated better. I don't believe that that is part of my abuse. Black women, on the other hand, I can tell you stories that would crush your soul. I think a lot of it is just our medical system. I mean, the Western medicine is just not equipped for really true holistic care and listening and being, you know, it just wasn't designed for that. And then there's a lot of corruption within OB care, I guess, because there's just, it pays more. It's when we have a for-profit health care system, it's just going to be inherently corruptive.
Yeah. And if you have trained surgeons, OBs are trained surgeons providing care, you're going to have higher rates of surgery.
Right. Right.
We have higher rates of surgery in the U.S. than they do in other countries where midwives are actually the providers of first line of care.
Of course. Of course.
Right. And yeah. Just even that's an abusive sort of systemic.
Exactly. Yeah. There's so many. Yeah. So many layers of it. And when I had given birth, it was even, you know, it was illegal to even have a home birth. Midwives are so restricted, all that stuff. So I think some of that is shifting now, thankfully. But they see everything like a problem. Like they treat birth like they're removing a bad appendix from you, right? They treat it like it's something women have been doing forever.
Yeah. And also that your body has enormous ways to manage pain because we've been doing this forever.
Yes. And adjust to it and know when it's time.
If given the right tools and the ability to trust yourself.
Yeah. But I think the Western model kind of trains you to not even trust yourself at all. Like, we have to keep checking your dilation. We have to keep monitoring and prodding and probing you to tell you what's happening in your own body. And you believe it.
This is also cultural, right? Like, the U.S. or just like Western cultures tend to sort of deprioritize the body and like being connected to the body. Whereas you look at more indigenous cultures that are like part of being alive is connecting to the earth and the spirits and also our bodies. And, you know, to be able to reclaim some of that, like, I know my body and you know what? I'm going to just really tune in to see what I need.
Right. It's part, function of colonization. Yeah. Cause we stripped everybody that was connected to the land when you take over and you don't have that. And then you start disconnecting from everything else as well.
You said something that really struck me, and you said, you were talking about the medical field, that there's no sense of true holistic care. And I'm wondering, like, what does true holistic care look like in your therapy practice?
So for me, it's not a transactional relationship. It's not, definitely not the 50 minutes. I'm building these sacred relationships with my clients. And I am within the community that I'm also healing them in. So a lot of times, like, there is going to be intersection. I take that with care, but I don't see it as like, I'm just this expert. I'm sitting here with you just this exact hour and telling you what to do. It's a very, very collaborative process. I see the relationship as the most sacred and what is going to be cherished and healed and is going to heal all of it. And the ability for the person sitting across from me to feel safe enough to just tap into all their own wisdom. A lot of it is, I do collaborative notes. We're figuring stuff out in real time. There's a lot of rupture and repair. There's a lot of room for rupture and repair within my therapeutic relationship. Yeah, and there's check-ins in between. It just feels like a very nice organic relationship. Even when I transition out to another therapist because I might have a blind spot, it's not never like this harsh breakup either, where I'm just, okay, yeah, maybe we'll check in every 3 months or something instead, but you've got to go to this other person for this care. It just feels like a very natural relational approach.
You prioritize the relationship. And I love that concept of sacred relationships, that the relationship is more important than anything else, and that they have a good experience of you as a therapist. Whether or not you can help them in what they need is paramount. As a therapist now, what do you think were the most formative experiences from your early childhood? We've talked about the impact of the medical trauma, but being of a different cultural background, and certainly in this country, growing up in mostly, I imagine, white spaces and white culture, you know, how do you think that impacted you into being the therapist you are today?
I honestly did not grow up in mostly white spaces. So I think coming here, that it was very jarring. I'm in Alabama, but like, I grew up in New York. So I really like did not grow up in white spaces. Like, most of my classes too were like mostly Asian. I had a very, very tight knit Muslim community. And then even outside of that, like, classes and Rutgers that I went to for undergrad, very Asian, like the campus that we were on, they called Asian Ave, they like dubbed it, right? It's just so, not till I went to EFT or in Alabama and stuff did I like, cause my friend Virginia will joke about it sometimes. There'd be something, I'm like, wait, why are they doing that? Or how, you know, why are they not really saying what they feel? Something like that. She's like, have you not been around white people? Like, have you not learned this yet?
For you, it was a culture shock. Like, you just weren't into it.
Yeah.
What brought you to Alabama?
My husband. So he had a job here, engineer. We were supposed to go for 2 years. Been 15.
It's a long time. But it does make me wonder, because you're saying, first of all, the reason I asked that question is I think I just had a very different experience than you did. And so it's very delightful for me to hear that you had a lot of people around you that you could see yourself in.
Yeah.
That's important. So important.
For sure.
Formative ages, like, to be able to see yourself in others and have them sort of reflect back who you are.
For sure. That's why, I mean, I see my kids not have that. And it's like, kind of, it's jarring, especially because it's like, yeah, I had that. And then I didn't have a lot of this shame. And I also grew up before 9/11. So that's a huge, huge difference, right? I mean, it is just embedded in everyone's psyche about how they see Muslims. It's just so deep. So that didn't exist. We're never going to go back to that kind of world. But like, saying the word Muslim when I was young, or it held no weight to it.
Yeah, the shift in Islamophobia since that day. people talk about that, like pre-9/11, post-9/11 experiences here. You said about EFT, and I kind of smiled because to me, EFT was just a natural progression of like kind of the other spaces that I had been in. But you're saying like that was so different for you. How do you adapt EFT then to work in a way that makes sense to you and with your clients? Because you're saying like, oh, that was very different. And like even the model, right? It's developed for, you know, mostly what Western culture, white cultures, dominant colonialist cultures, and cis het couples. How do you modify that for your more diverse?
And I had interviewed Paul Guillory a little a while ago, and he talked about this. He's like, we all just do it naturally. Anyone who works with like, he's like, and that's something also that I've just done in general in life. Like you go into spaces, you know, when you go to a training, go to a different anything, even if it's not psychology based, you know, it's like kind of made for the dominant culture, and then you're gonna go and like kind of pick or choose, right? You're used to doing it. You don't even realize you're doing it because you're always doing it.
It kind of comes code switching in a way.
It's like, so natural.
I'm going to take it here and yeah. I'm going to make it real.
Right. It's different now because I'm like doing that less because I'm like becoming more authentic. And so not doing that feels different. But the way that it's adapted, I think for me, which is ironic, but the model actually helps you adapt the model because the model requires you to really be yourself constantly. It's not like other therapy models where you're just using a technique. Because if you're not attuned and you're not yourself and you're just like doing the techniques, it just doesn't work. So you have to constantly be checking in with yourself. You have to constantly be attuned to the other person. And so if you're trying to plug in something and it's not working, it's because there's some misattunement there, right? And then you feel it. You just feel it. So that, yeah.
You feel like you're trying to force something.
Yes. It's just that dance of attunement. Constantly. And I'm just a very more intuitive person in general. So it's like I'm just constantly engaging for when I'm feeling that plugged into that other person. So, I mean, I think then the moves of it naturally adapt. I'm not like consciously adapting it with different people that are in my room.
It totally makes sense. And it goes back to the concept of like sacred relationships, right? Like you have to be authentic in yourself to actually be able to attune well to others versus fake attuning, right? Which is saying the right thing. Yeah. Because people feel like you're not entirely there. Well, I want to say that I'm so appreciative of just like your journey. You know, here you are talking so openly about your life and the things you learned, who you are. And you're also sharing that like when you started out life, you were actually very quiet. You didn't share a lot. You felt you just wanted to be not seen. And here you are with a podcast and also just sharing your story and just seeing how you are a whole full person now in your life. Just really appreciating it and even getting a chance to get to know you better.
Thank you for your time and your thoughtful questions.
Wait, I have one more question.
Oh, okay.
Mike, I like to ask this at the end of any kind of interview, or is there anything that you wish I had asked you that I didn't? That you feel like it's important to share to just round out like who you are as a person?
I am going to steal that question for all my attachment histories.
That's a good one.
There's nothing that specific question or anything comes to mind, I'm sure, after this. I think this just being my last episode, I just won't feel complete unless I talk about Palestine to some extent, which I don't even have anything specific that I want to say or can come off the top of my head to say. But it is just something that has greatly shifted me in say, a profound way. It is something that is horrific that is happening right now. So just to not acknowledge the reality of that anytime I get a chance to, because it's denied so often, I just want to give that space.
Absolutely. And you've said too that this podcast wouldn't exist without the genocide.
Yeah, I think that propelled me into my decolonization journey for sure. I had always been doing kind of the adjustments with different cultures, and I was doing that coaching, all that stuff before. But then when this started and the reaction to it just tore my world into two different parts completely, because it was like half my world was grieving and outraged and watching these images and what the hell is happening? Let's this stop. And then the other half is like going to brunch, right? So it was just so disorienting and jarring. I can't even describe that, but it turned everything on its head, and it made me spiral into a lot of different realizations. It made me realize the level of right proximity privilege that I have as well, because it was like, it's kind of like 9/11 again, but on steroids. Like, oh shit, yeah, I am Muslim, you know, in these spaces. a lot of space. I'm light skinned. I'm like, so it, people forget. I forget and I shift in ways that it doesn't impact anything. But after this happened, it was like I couldn't make those shifts anymore. And I just was like unapologetically constantly Muslim. And I saw how uncomfortable that made people. I've lost a lot of friendships. I've had to distance myself from certain EFT groups and stuff. And it's shifted a lot of things. I'm in that growth period right now. But I did create this also because I know there's other voices like that. And I want to amplify certain voices that are not getting amplified.
Well, thank you for just stating that and naming that. And also just like where we are too as a society. There is this split. It creates in a lot of us who are understanding the gravity of the genocide and being horrified. It creates an existential question about humanity. It's actually really disturbing. I understand when you're saying my whole world split in two and it put into sharp focus what was important to me and how I want to show up in the world and being unapologetically Muslim and starting this podcast and really speaking out against oppression in every way. Even earlier, you talking about the experience Black women have in the medical profession and certainly in maternal rates of mortality for Black women and recognizing your own privilege, but also that you're not entirely safe. There's going to be certain markers in our history that put that into sharp focus. And right now, we're in a period of time that does put that in a sharp focus.
I think that was well said about kind of the Asian experience. We understand our privilege, but then in some other ways, we're like not safe either.
Well, thank you so much for your time and openness and willingness to let me get to know you and interview you. And it's been a delight to be here with you in this.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Join the movement and keep the conversation going at deconstructingtherapy.com. And follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at Deconstructing Therapy. If you found value in today's episode, please subscribe and rate us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you are able to and would like to help sustain the podcast, you can find us at buymeacoffee.com/deconstructingtherapy to show your support. Thank you for listening.